Blog Talk Radio.
You'd left it a long time. Welcome to the January 19th, 2013 version of Masonic Home Companion. And thank you for tuning in again. Today we're going to, of course, celebrate the upcoming 25th anniversary of the birth of Robert Burns. And we'll do that in proper style, I hope. Not to neglect the fellow. I'll talk a little bit about. I think we need to talk a little bit about why this fellow has resonated, why his memory is still with us and celebrated all these years later. So on the 25th of January, of course. Just like on St. Patrick's Day, everybody's Irish. On the 25th, everybody is a member of a clan. You're all Scottish, probably directly or indirectly, and genetically, everybody on the planet is one way or another. The people of Scottish heritage are a friendly bunch and quite hospitable, and you know. But we know how people talk, don't we? I want to talk a little bit about some of the comings and goings and things Masonic. And again, thank you so very much for the support. It's getting so widespread, I'm about to blush. Well, I'm not, but you know what I mean. It's a wonderful day here. I hope you've all been committing at least a couple of random acts of Masonic kindness and to make it sublime, doing it anonymously. Because the idea is to be conscious of that. And to thank you for doing that, I'm going to give you some useless facts of history. Is that okay? Something that you can whip out of your pocket when those upstarts start to swamp you with her trivia. Did you know that the first man to distill bourbon whiskey in the United States was a Baptist preacher? That was in 1789. Of course, he was probably trying to come up with something that was close to a fairly rough scotch, but we'll give him the credit for that. Did you know that the Aztec Indians of Mexico believed turquoise would protect them from physical harm? So warriors used those little green and blue stones to decorate their battle shields. I wish it was that simple. Here's something that have you ever heard the term chintzy? Something cheap and not exactly of good quality. Well, that is an interesting origin. It starts more than 5,000 years ago. The Chinese discovered how to make silk from silkworms, silkworm cocoons. For about 3,000 years, the Chinese kept this discovery a secret. Maybe that's where Freemasons got the idea that they could keep secrets. 3,000 years. Let's pull up our socks, lads. Because poor people could not afford real silk, they tried to make other cloth look silky. Women would beat on cotton with sticks to soften the fibers. Then they rubbed it against a big stone to make it shiny. The shiny cotton was called chintz. Because chintz was a cheaper copy of silk, calling something chintzy meant it was cheap and not of good quality. So there you have it. You heard of that? Heard material called that? No, did you know the pharaohs of ancient Egypt wore garments made from thin threads of beaten gold? Now, you and I know that we may not think of that as such a big deal because we've seen Elvis in his gold suit, but nevertheless, some fabrics had up to 500 gold threads per 1 inch of cloth. Fancy. A little bling. They would have done well in the glam rock days, wouldn't they? The ancient Egyptians recommended mixing half an onion with beer foam as a way of warding off death. You know? The Chinese in olden days used marijuana only as a remedy for dysentery. Scientific America carried the first magazine automobile ad in 1898. The Winton Motor Car Company of Cleveland, Ohio, invited readers to dispense with a horse. Not so very long ago. In France, Captain Scarrat made the first parachute jump from an airplane in 1918. Now that's that. If that doesn't link us with roots, the first paperback book was printed by Penguin Publishing in 1935. In 1956, the year of, they made a nice Chevy. The phrase "In God We Trust" was adopted as the U.S. national motto. We've all seen. It was around. It was after that. Maybe about the same time. You've all seen the Pledge of Allegiance, Kevin, where we would stand with our hands over our hearts. Well, in the first, before that, it was made with a salute, with the hand and arms straight out. But as the a political party in Germany became more and more prominent and unpleasant, it was decided that that was just too close for comfort. And they dispensed with that and used the hand over heart. Freemasons may have a firmer understanding of that. Henry Ford, always a genius, everything he said was true, stated that history is bunk. Hank made more than a few mistakes. So, but he didn't, he was a man that was convinced that the only person worth listening to was himself, I think. But anyway, I won't get into that. I think he was probably an interesting man, but certainly single-minded and driven. You can give him his dues. The first Inuit Bible was printed in Copenhagen in 1744. Man. Did you know the last words spoken from the moon were from Eugene Cernan, commander of the Apollo 17 mission, on 11 December 1972? Here's what he said. "As we leave the moon at Taurus Lithro, we leave it as we came, and God willing, we shall return with peace and hope for all mankind." Man, I may not have had had the greatest grasp of the English language, but it was the meaning. On this day in history, in the year 250, Saint Fabian ends his reign as Catholic Pope. And in 820, the Book of Mother was published. I haven't seen that. Did you know that in 1513, the Christian II succeeded Johann I as the Danish-Norwegian king? I was wondering what happened, eh, Chris? And, you know, I'm glad I found that out. In, man, those of Cornerstone ilk will be pleased to know that Cornerstone of Amsterdam Town Hall was laid in 1648. And in 1667, the Treaty of Andrusovo ended 13 years of war between Poland and Russia. In 1778, the first American military court-martial trial began in Cambridge, Massachusetts. In 1807, Napoleon convened a great Sanhedrin in Paris. And in 1841, China ceded Hong Kong to the British. We know that that's come full circle. And in 1870, the city of Boston vanishes at sea with all 177 aboard the ship, of course. The first lady to testify before Congress was Elizabeth Cady Stanton. It was in 1869. 1887, the U.S. Senate approved the naval base lease of Pearl Harbor. And in 1892, the first basketball game was played in Massachusetts, of course. Oh, 1930, the first radio broadcast of the Lone Ranger on WXYZ in Detroit. WXYZ still broadcasts, of course. And if some of you have cable or radio, you'll be able to hear the old radio broadcast. Still amazing. Béla Bartók, wonderful composer, premiered his sixth string quartet in New York City in 1941. And then there's stuff about battles and wars that are remembered well in other places. In 1956, Buddy Holly records Blue Days, Black Night in Nashville. And life goes on. Robert Frost recites Gift outright at John F. K.'s inauguration in 1961. Now, that's a point of amazing history. You can tell that the references I'm getting are loaded with one country. You know, you see a picture of a map of Canada that's produced by our friends in Newfoundland, and Newfoundland turns out to be larger than the rest of Canada put together. So this is an important day. Important day. I think this is what? Aquarius. You're born around this time, between the 21st of January and the 19th of February. So we're just passing out. This is we're still in Capricorn right now, aren't we? So, Jesus was a Capricorn. I wonder what Muhammad was. Oh, peace be with him. And Buddha. I'm not sure. Anyway, we need to talk a little bit about the Baird. I'm just going to try and attempt something very, probably a bit sketchy right now. I'm trying to hook up some music to a little bit of music from the works of Robbie Burns, but I'm not too sure if our system will hold it together here. If it does, it does. If it doesn't, it doesn't. I don't think it does. Robert Burns collection, the Bonnie Lass of Ballycrum. We'll look it back and try that again. It sounds like it worked. If it did, this is great. If it didn't, I'm just going to be at a loss to fill in the dead space, aren't I? I want to talk to you a little bit about, for this show, this is quite a sentimental time for me. Of course, Graham is pleased to be routed in history in Scotland. The Bonnie Dundee and McKee and the names show up in the various battles of Scotland. in history, showing that we were accounted. My grandfather Cyril passed away a number of years ago, well into his 80s. The old farmer and a very worshipful brother from Prince Edward Island, from Restigo, if any of you have been through there. I was born over in Cavendish, which you know is a cart ride away. So on his passing, one of the few things that I was given from his estate was this copy of Robbie Burns' poems. It's heavily stained leather bound. And it was printed in 1800. And in the front of it, in his handwriting, he writes that Burns was born on the 25th of January, 1759, and he died July 21st, 1796, the age of 37. And my dear old Grampy gave me the theme for another show, another talk with you. Right underneath, he writes about another Mason, Lord Byron, born January 27th, 1788, and died April 19th, 1894, and he was aged 36. Another incredibly well-known poet. Now, of course, I don't mean to assault anybody's sensibilities, but I prefer and I trust when I know that the people that we're talking about are real boys, real people. I appreciate Albert Pike for all the controversy that has come with that material of his. He was real. He wasn't, you know, when somebody professes to be perfect, and at least in my experience, it's something, something's not quite what it seems. And so that naivete is gone. Thank goodness. Robbie Burns is a real man. Maybe that's why we ask ourselves as you listen today, why do you think he endures? His name and his memories endure as long as they have. Maybe it's because of what Robbie Burns stands for. And maybe it's because what he stood for inspires all of us to realize that perhaps there is that common man within us. I'll just talk to you a little bit about this. Then if we've got enough time, I know that some of you are maybe curious about some of the appended groups. I have a short paper on the history and development of the York Rite Masonry, and I think that this is, for me, so far, the defining piece that I've ever read on it, and I'll try and share that with you. Now, and I thank my very good friend Robert for passing on his material on Robert Burns, and great discussions, and the music that you're hearing today is from his collection. And I hope that when you're listening to the program, that you will be comfortable in a comfortable atmosphere. And truly, if you can archive this and listen to it when you can wrap your fingers around something nice and pleasant, whether it's a great cup of coffee or a single or whatever it is that strikes your fancy, and sit back and close your eyes and let the mood of Robbie Burns take you to another time and another place inside of yourself. As my grampy, as Cyril wrote, Robert Burns was born on the 25th of January, so when you're out there, enjoy, or at least think of the man. His father, William Burns, or Burness, was of the north of Scotland at Kincardineshire. His ancestors, many generations, had been farmers. He was thrown by early misfortunes on the world at large, says the poet in his biographical letter to Dr. Moore. And there, he adds, after many years' wanderings and sojournings, I picked up a pretty large quantity of observation and experience to which I am indebted for most of my little pretensions of wisdom. I have made I have met with few who understood men, their manners and their ways equal to him. But stubborn, ungainly integrity and headlong, ungovernable irascibility are disqualifying circumstances. Consequently, I was born a very poor man's son. Think about what he's telling us. It's interesting how he became so sensitive and to be able to observe those threads in people. After and that it mattered to him. That's perhaps why Cyril, why this copy of his poetry is so heavily thumbed. I know that Cyril would take this out to one of the back fields where there was a bush, and he would harvest trees and cut the firewood and put it up and let it season. And he would read this alone. Maybe this tells me why, tells us. And it tells you a little bit about the kind of fellow that my grandfather was. After several years' residence near Edinburgh, he took 7 acres of land in Doonside with the intention of becoming a nurseryman, but was engaged as gardener and overseer to Mr. Ferguson in Dunholm. He retained the land, and on one spot of it built a clay biggin, or cottage, divided into a kitchen with a recess for a bed and a spence, or sitting room, with a fireplace and chimney. Gilbert Burns remarked long afterwards that when it was altogether cast over inside and out with lime, it had a neat and comfortable appearance. It still stands and is used as a Burns Museum. Here in December 1757, he brought his bride, Agnes Brown, the daughter of a Carrick farmer, a red-haired, dark-eyed, hot-tempered lassie, 11 years his junior. Robert was their firstborn. When he was 7 years old, his father became tenant of a small farm belonging to Mr. Ferguson in Mount Oliphant, not far from the mouth of Bonny Doon. The land was poor, and after the death of their generous master, they fell into the hands of a factor who, says Burns, sat for the picture that he drew of one in his tale of twa dogs. Now, that's a poem that we'll get into. Still more trying was their life at Terrebonne on the Aire, where they took a larger farm in 1777. At first they lived comfortably, but a difference as to terms arose, and after 3 years tossing and whirling in the vortex of litigation, the suit was decided in favor of the landlord, and William Burness, whose health and spirit were entirely broken, died in February 1784. Just saved from the horrors of a jail. Robert began to go to school when he was 6 years old. In 1765, John Murdoch, a young man of 18, became his teacher. In his recollections, Murdoch says that Robert and Gilbert were generally near the head of their classes, even when ranged with boys by far their seniors. He says they committed to memory the hymns and other poems of Masson's collection with uncommon facility. But strangely enough, the two boys were behind all the others in music. Robert's ear, says Murdoch, was remarkably dull and his voice untunable. It was long before I could get them to distinguish one tone from another. And in conclusion, he declares that certainly if any person who knew the two boys had been asked which of them was the most likely to court the muses, he would surely never have guessed that Robert had a propensity of that kind. Although it cost the schoolmaster some thrashing, says Burns, I made an excellent English scholar. And by the time I was 10 or 11 years of age, I was a critic in substantives, verbs, and particles. In my infant and boyish days, too, I owe much to an old woman who resided in the family, remarkable for her ignorance, credulity, and superstition. She had, I suppose, the largest collection in the country of tales and songs concerning devils, ghosts, fairies, brownies, witches, warlocks, spunkies, kelpies, elf candles, death lights, wraiths, apparitions, cantrips, enchanted towers, giants, dragons, and other trumpery. This cultivated the latent seeds of poesy, the earliest composition that I recollect taking pleasure in was The Vision of Mizra, and a hymn of Addison's beginning, How are thy servants blessed, O Lord? He says that the first books that he read in private were The Life of Hannibal, lent to him by Mr. Murdoch, and The History of Sir William Wallace, which he procured from a neighboring blacksmith, and declares that Hannibal gave his young ideas such a turn that he used to strut in rapture up and down after the recruiting drum and bagpipe and wish himself tall enough to be a soldier. While the story of Wallace poured into his veins a Scottish prejudice which would boil along there till the floodgates of life shut in eternal rest. Salmon's and Guthrie's geographical grammars told him all that he knew of ancient history. His ideas of modern manners of literature and criticism he got from The Spectator, the paper. Pope's works, some of Shakespeare's plays, Locke's Essay on Human Understanding. By the way, I recommend that. Take a look at that. Locke's with an E. Essay on Human Understanding. Alan Ramsay's works, Taylor's Scripture Doctrine of Original Sin, and again, pivotal, Ramsay with an two A's, a select collection of English songs, Hervey's Meditation, and a few other books, Hervey's, H-E-R-V-E-Y-S, for those of you who are scribbling. The collection of songs, he says, was his Vade Mecum. I pored over them, driving my cart or walking to labor, song by song, verse by verse, carefully noting the true, tender, or sublime from affection and Houston. I am convinced, he adds, I owe to this practice much of my critic craft, which as it is. After Mr. Murdoch, who was unfortunately addicted to the use of ardent spirits, left Mr. Oliphant, he sometimes came back to make visits, and on one occasion read Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus. And it was said that Robert's pure taste rose in a passionate revolt against its coarse cruelties and unspiritual horrors. Murdoch also helped him to a small knowledge of French. But when a lady once asked him if he had studied Latin, he replied, All I know of Latin is contained in three words. Omnia vincit amor. Go and Google that one. After the removal of the family to Lochiel in 1777, he received from his father yearly wages of £7 sterling. In order to give his manners a brush, as he expresses it, he, at that time, began to go to a country dancing school. His father had an unaccountable antipathy against such meetings, and indeed he had reason to tremble for his son. On his deathbed, when Robert was present alone with him and his sister, Mrs. Begg, he confessed that there was only one of his family for whose future he feared. Robert asked, Oh, Father, is it me you mean? And when the old man said it was, Robert turned to the window and burst into tears. Robert had already been initiated into the delirious society of love and had committed the sin of rhyme. When he was about 16, his partner in the harvesting war was Miss Nellie Kilpatrick, known as Handsome Nell, a girl a year younger than himself. Among her other love-inspiring qualities, she sang sweetly, and it was to her favorite reel that he first attempted to fit words. It was the song beginning, Oh, once I loved a bonny lass, aye, and I love her still, and whilst that virtue warms my breast, I love my handsome Nell. Fa-la de la. His own criticism upon it in his Commonplace book is interesting and curious. After taking it up stanza by stanza, he adds, I remember I composed it in wild enthusiasm of passion And to this hour I never recollect it, but my heart melts. My blood sallies in the remembrance. The dancing school offered further opportunities in what the Scotch called sweethearting. Burns, who saw no way to rise above his surroundings and yet had a vast ambition, became discouraged and simply drifted with the tide. He says of this period, "My heart was completely tender and was internally lighted up by some goddess or other. And as in every other warfare in the world, my fortune was various. Sometimes I was received with favor, and sometimes I was mortified with a repulse. At the plow, scythe, the reap hook, I feared no competitor, and thus I set absolute want at defiance. And as I never cared further for my labors than while I was in actual exercise, I spent the evenings in the way that of my own heart. All this was a dangerous but powerful training for the profession of minnesinger. When he was 18 years of age, he studied mensuration, surveying, drilling, and kindred branches of practical knowledge under the parish schoolmaster of Kirkoswald in the district of Carrick, where he spent some time, probably with his mother's relatives. The schoolmaster, whose name was Roger, was skilled in mathematics, but possessed a narrow understanding and little general knowledge. He discovered that Burns and a youth called Willie were in the habit of holding disputations or arguments on speculative questions. This seemed to him absurd, and one day when the whole school was assembled, he went up to the two young men and began very sarcastically to twit them on their debates. The other scholars who had been invited to join in these intellectual disputes, but who preferred ball or shinty, burst into uproarious laughter at the teacher's wit. Willie replied that he was sorry to find that Robert and he had given offense, that it was unintentional. Indeed, they supposed he would be pleased to know that their attempts to improve their minds. Roger asked what they disputed about, and Willie replied that their question that day had been whether a great general or a respectable merchant were the most valuable member of society. The master, laughing contemptuously at the silliness of such a question, said that there could be no doubt about it, and was drawn into an argument by Burns, who easily got the better of him. Failing to regain his superiority, Roger fell into such a pitiable state of vexation that he had to dismiss the school. But it was not altogether mental improvement he found at this noted school. That wild coast was the resort of smugglers. He made good progress in his mathematics, as he says he made greater progress in the knowledge of mankind. The contraband trade was at that time very successful, and it sometimes happened to me to fall in with those who carried it on. Scenes of swaggering riot and roaring dissipation were, till this time, new to me. But I was no enemy to social life. Here, though, I learnt to fill my glass and to mix without fear in a drunken squabble. Yet I went on with a high hand with my geometry till the sun entered Virgo, a month which is always a carnival in my bosom. When a charming fillet who lived next door to the school overset my trigonometry and set me off at a tangent from the spheres of my studies. The image of that modest and innocent girl effectually prevented any more attempts to measure the sun's altitude. Study was useless, but the emulation of the passion was only a song, one of his most beautiful beginning, now westland winds and slot ring guns. On his return to Tarbolton, he further indulged his love of discussion by joining with his brother Gilbert and five other young men in establishing a debating society, where the young people set for themselves such questions as, suppose a young man bred a farmer, but without any fortune, has it in his power to marry either of two women, the one a girl of large fortune, and neither handsome in person nor agreeable in conversation, but who can manage the household affairs of a farm well enough. The other of them, a girl every way agreeable in person, conversation, and behavior, but without any fortune. Which of them shall he choose? Atterbolton also, while still under his father's roof, Burns wrote several of his finest and sweetest songs. Beyond yon hills where Liger flows, mangmoors and mosses many, oh, the wintry sun, the day has closed, and Iowa to Nanny, oh. And it was upon a Lammas night, when corn rigs are bonny, beneath the moon's unclouded light, I held away to Annie. And more than one in praise of Terbolton lasses, there's few say bonny, none say good, in a King George's dominion. While still at Terbolton, Burns was introduced to his friend John Rankin to join St. Mary's Lodge of Freemasons. And he became, like Mozart, and about the same time, an enthusiastic member of the order. St. Mary's Lodge. Got it? When he was about 23 years old, he conceived the idea of going into the flax business, so he went to live with a flax dresser named Peacock, a relative of his mother's in the neighboring town of Irvine. Among his acquaintances at Irvine, there was a small seaport which also were also smugglers whose influence upon him was not good. And his chief friend was a young fellow named Richard Brown, whom he called a very noble character, but a hapless son of misfortune. This noble fellow, whose mind was fraught with independence, magnanimity, and every manly virtue, was the only man, Burns confesses, who was a greater fool than himself, where woman was the presiding star. He spoke of illicit love with the levity of a sailor, which hitherto I had regarded with horror. Here his friendship did me a mischief, and the consequence was that soon I had assumed the plow. After I had assumed the plow, I wrote the poet's welcome. The illegitimate daughter thus welcomed bore a striking resemblance to Burns. She married Mr. John Bishop at Polkman and died in 1817. It is proper to add that the poet was afterwards stung by a manly sorrow in the tone in which this poem to his shame was written. Doubtless his recklessness was partly due to the fact that he had just been disappointed in the hopes of marrying Miss Alison Bigby, an amiable, intelligent, not particularly handsome girl, in the service of a family on the banks of the Kisnuck. To her he wrote the song, "On Kisnuck banks a lassie dwells, could I describe her shape and mien? Our lassies she far excels, and she twa sparkling roguish een." He was deeply in love with her, but her affections were given to another. He was at that time suffering from a nervous disorder, and his constitutional hypochondria, inherited from his father, was intensified by the depressed effects of dissipation. His gloomy state of mind may be seen in certain passages of a letter written to his father 2 days after Christmas in 1781, or it might have been 82. He wasn't doing well. "Honored sir, my health is nearly the same as when you were here, only my sleep is a little sounder, and on the whole I am rather better than otherwise, though I mend my very slow degrees. The weakness of my nerves has so debilitated my mind that I dare neither review past events nor look forward into futurity, for the least anxiety or perturbation in my breast produces most unhappy effects on my whole frame. Sometimes, indeed, when for an hour or two my spirits are a little lighted, I glimmer a little into futurity. But my principal, indeed, my only pleasurable employment is looking backwards and forwards on a moral and religious way. I am quite transported at the thought that ere long, perhaps very soon, I shall bid an eternal adieu to all the pains and uneasiness and disquietudes of this very weary life. For I assure you, I am heartily tired of it. And if I do not very much deceive myself, I could contentedly and gladly resign it. As for this world, I despair of ever making a figure in it. I am not formed for the bustle of this busy, of the busy, nor the flutter of the gay. I shall never again be capable of entering into such scenes. Indeed, I am altogether unconcerned at the thoughts of this life. I foresee that poverty and obscurity probably await me, and I am in some measure prepared, and daily prepared to meet them. I have but just time and paper to return you my grateful thanks for the lessons of virtue and piety you have given me, which were too much neglected at the time of giving them, but which I hope have been remembered ere it is yet too late. 3 days later, while he and some of his friends were giving a welcome carousal to the new year, the shop was set on fire and totally destroyed, so that he was left, like a true poet, not worth a sixpence. He attributed it to the drunken carelessness of his partner's wife. His partner he called a scoundrel of the first water, who made money by the misery of thieving. A year or two afterwards, in March 1784, he wrote in his commonplace book, "There was a certain period in my life that my spirit was broken by repeated losses and disasters, which threatened and indeed affected the utter ruin of my fortune. My body, too, was attacked by that most dreadful distemper, a hypochondria, or confirmed melancholy. In this wretched state, the recollection of which makes me yet shudder, I hung my harp on the willow trees, except in some lucid intervals, in one of which I composed the prayer under the pressure of violent anguish, which begins, O thou great being, what thou art, surpasses me to know, yet sure I am, that known to thee are all thy works below." The man was depressed. But at last the cloud passed, as is shown by the cheerfulness of his extempore lines, which are referred to the following April. "Oh, why the deuce should I repine that, and be at all ill forbearer? I'm 23 and 5'9". I'll go and be a sodder. I got some gear with mickle care. I held it wheeled together. But now it's gone and something's mair. I'll go and be a sodder." After his return to Laclea, he and his brother Gilbert hired a farm of 119 acres at Mosgiel, near the village of Maclean, at an annual rental of £90. 3 months later, their father died, leaving his affairs in utter ruin. "His all," says Burns, "went among the hellhounds that growl in the kennel of justice. As his sons and two married daughters ranked as creditors for years of wages, they saved a little money from the wreck, and the whole family moved to Mosgiel in March of 1784. Gilbert Burns bears witness to his brother's steadiness and industry during their joint partnership, but after all, the drudgery of farming was irksome to a poet. It was Pegasus harnessed to a plow." And he wrote, the poems that he wrote all reflect his, like all good poets, reflect what he was going through at the time. So they're windows. Read his poetry, I suggest, and think about the mood that it conjures in you. Now, the most of the work, as you can see that I'm stumbling over some of the pronunciation, it's because it was written in a dialect. And we know that Robert Burns was the very first poet to write in a local or common man dialect. At the time, the dialects in certain regions were so distinct that it was hard to distinguish one from the other, and it was hard in some places to even understand, because they were so distinct, and along with what you and I would call an accent. So we know that he was the first. We know that he had a point. He saw nobility in the things around him. one of the things I've read about Burns is that his claim that he would not be understood for 100 years after his death. But as we know, as we go along here, we know that his fame grew while he was still alive, although he had a very short life. And for that, we're fortunate that he was prolific. Prolific. Burns was very fond of his Bonnie Jean, and he wrote that though he had not a hope or a wish to make her his after her conduct, yet when he was told that the names were out of the informal marriage contract, his heart died within him, and his veins were cut with the news. The Darling Jean is celebrated in his epistle to Davy, and in many other poems was Jean Amour, a comely country lass, whom he met at a penny wedding in Maclean. They chanced to be dancing in the same quadrille when the poet's dog sprang to his master and almost upset some of the dancers. Burns remarked that he wished he could get any of the lasses to like him as well as his old dog did. Some days afterward, Jean, seeing him pass as she was bleaching clothes on the village green, called to him and asked if he had as yet got any of the lasses to like him as well as his old dog did. This was the beginning of an acquaintance which colored all of Burns' life. In the spring of 1786, he learned that she was about to become a mother. In Scotland, at that time, a license and a ceremony were not required in order to legalize a marriage. Burns, who was inclined to be honorable, gave Jean a written acknowledgement of marriage, a sufficient reparation in the eyes of the law. But the Master Mason, her father, compelled her to destroy the paper and to have nothing more to do with Burns, who was then in the straits of poverty owing to a succession of bad crops, and who was with some reason looked upon by the pious inhabitants of that parish as little better than a pariah. This was in April. It was under the gloom of this bitter trouble that Burns wrote his lament, occasioned by the unfortunate issue of a friend's amour. O thou pale orb that silence shines while care untroubled mortals sleep. You can see what effect looking at the moon had on this poor man. The friend, of course, was his best friend and his worst enemy, himself. Burns was really very fond of Bonnie Jean, and he wrote that though he had not a hope or a wish to make her his after her conduct, yet when he was told that the names were out of the informal marriage contract, his heart died. Emerson says, "Nature's darlings, the great, the strong, the beautiful, are not children of our law. Do not come out of the Sunday school, nor weigh their food, nor punctually keep the commandments." So much the worse for them. The destruction of the paper did not, of course, absolve Burns, but he determined to leave Scotland forever. He entered into negotiations with Dr. John Hamilton with a view of going to Jamaica as bookkeeper on a plantation there. While this matter was pending and while he was still sore at the treatment which he had received from the Amours, Mary Campbell, known to fame as Highland Mary, a most sprightly blue-eyed creature of great modesty and self-respect, who had been in the service of his friend and landlord Gavin Hamilton, showed so much sympathy for him that Burns considered himself free, offered to make her his wife, and she agreed to go with him to Jamaica. She left Maclean and started on foot for Campbellton in the Highlands, where her father was a sailor. Burns accompanied her. It was the second Sunday in May, 1786. They reached a sequestered spot on the banks of the Aire. Now a railway runs within a few yards of it, and there the parting took place. According to tradition, they stood on opposite sides of a slow-running brook and dipped their hands into the pure water, swore solemn vows to be true, and one till death. At the Burns Monument at Ayr are preserved the Bibles which they exchanged. Mary's gift to Burns is a small, plain one, his to her a dainty edition in two volumes. In one of them, the poet wrote the scripture verse, "Ye shall not swear by my name falsely, I am the Lord." And in the other, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. The poem to Mary is referred by Burns to this time when he was thinking of going to the West Indies. Will you go to the Indies, my Mary, and leave old Scotia's shore? Will you go to the Indies, my Mary, across the Atlantic's roar? Nothing more was said about Mary Campbell going to Jamaica with him. Indeed, he never saw her again. After making her visit at Campbellton, he started for Glasgow to take the prosaic place of a servant, while stopping at Greenock to care for a sick brother. She caught the fever and died. There is nothing in Burns' behavior or his letters to indicate that this poetic ending of a miserable story was regarded as anything but a relief. When he heard the news, his face changed and he left the house, but he said nothing about it, and only his immortal poem, To Mary in Heaven, written years after, shows that it made an impression on him. On the contrary, it was probably only a hasty episode conducted partly under an influence of pique, and so he continued his preparations for his journey and wrote his rhymes and conceived the idea of publishing them. In the following June of 1786, he wrote to Mr. David Bryce, a shoemaker in Glasgow, a full account of his trouble. He said, "Poor, ill-advised, ungrateful Amor came home on Friday last. Have you heard all the particulars of that affair? And a black affair it was. What she thinks of her conduct now, I don't know. One thing I do know, that she made me completely miserable. Never man loved, or rather adored, a woman more than I did her. And I confess in truth, between you and me, I do still love her to distraction after all, though I won't tell her. So if I were to see her, which I don't want to do, my poor dear unfortunate Jean, how unhappy I have been in thy arms. It is not the losing her which makes me so unhappy, but for her sake. I feel most severely. I foresee she is in the road to, and I am afraid, eternal ruin. May Almighty God forgive her ingratitude and perjury to me, as I from my very soul forgive her. And may His grace be with her and bless her in all her fortune, future life. I could have no nearer idea of the place of eternal punishment than what I have felt in my own breast on her account. I have tried often to forget her. I have run into all kinds of dissipation and riots, mason meetings, drinking matches, and other mischief to drive her out. And now for a grand cure, the ship is on her way home, and this is to take me to Jamaica. And then farewell, dear old Scotland, and farewell, dear ungrateful Jean, for never, never will I see you more." Wore his emotion on his sleeve, or he committed and felt deeply about it. Many of his songs were household words in his neighborhood. He had won unstinted applause and even more unbounded blame by his satiric verses occasioned by a quarrel which was dividing the parish at that day, and into which he entered with all the zeal of his impetuous nature. The descendants or representatives of the old covenanters, naturally proud of their distinction, clung to a fierce and unmodified Calvinism. Their clergy and the elders of the kirk possessed a moral dominion which had become a veritable tyranny, extending from the weightier matters of the law even down to the merest trifles of conduct or opinion. This party was called the Oldlichts. Opposed to them were the New Lights or Moderates, who believed that Christians had no right to lay down the law upon their brethren in matters of faith and practice, and that the Kirk Session, that is, the Committee of the Elders, existed simply to assist the minister in knowing his congregation. The two ministers of air belonged to the New Lights, and one of them, Dr. McGill, had undergone persecution. Byrne's kind landlord and friend, Gavin Hamilton, had been absent from church two or three Sundays, and it was discovered by questioning the servants that he was remiss in his ordinances of family worship. He had also neglected to pay a small church rate. He was selected as a special victim of the dominant party. Burns, whose father was a moderate, naturally sympathized with that side. And the armor of the evangelicals was not arrowproof. The shafts of ridicule could find joints to pierce, and worse yet, vital places were not protected. Some of the most violent persecutors of Gavin Hamilton were secretly guilty of unworthy practices, and Burns was alert to seize every chance. Thus, he picked out Mr. William Fisher, one of Kirk's elders at McLean, and gibbeted him on the doggerel rhymes, unfortunately not guiltless of vulgarity, entitled Holy Willie's Prayer. O thou way in the heavens dost lost, why, as it pleases thee yet thyself, sends in to heaven and tend to hell, for the glory and for no own good or ill they've done before. He was sending people and judging people for nothing. The attack was, after all, not so disreputable as the elder's own career. Barnes called him a hypocrite. He wrote of he was worse. He afterwards was found guilty of embezzling church funds, and he died in a ditch into which he had fell while elevated, as they then called being tipsy. Two old light divines had quarreled about their parish boundaries, and Burns satirized them in his Twaherds. So, the sacraments of the Lord's Supper had in many places gradually degenerated into a sort of carousal where there was much eating and drinking, much gossip, and even flirtation. This state of things Burns satirized in his poem entitled The Holy Fair. Upon a summer Sunday morn, when nature's face is fair, I walk forth to view the corn and snuff the colour air. The rising sun our glossing mirrors with glorious light was glinting. The hares were herping down the furrows. The lavlocks were chanting for sweet that day. As lightsomely the poet glowers abroad to see a scene so gay, three hizzies, fun, superstition, and hypocrisy come skipping up the way. So Burns was using poetry to describe some of the angst, anguish, and hypocrisy of common life. And no, we're not talking about a time gone past. Those qualities are still part of our communities, part of the existence of the people who ascribe to be known as pious. He's saying, I think, that what we all know. Every one of us has skeletons. Every one of us has experienced, in order to develop a sense of guilt and conscience, learn from a sense of blame and doubt, and we resolve these things. Is it proper to bring a man's embarrassments to him every single time we greet him? Of course not. Only a fool would do that. An insensitive fool. But what he's talking to us about is the better man being one who learns and uses his own experience in his judgments and manner with other people. I began, as I was reading through this material, to wonder if in some way I'm looking for things that accommodate the Mason. In one of the charges we learn, a man going about his business content within himself. And here I find that when that's said, it doesn't distinguish that this is a man with a pasty, supercilious smile on his face. We're talking about a real human being that, in spite of the grind of daily life and the vicissitudes, is able to find reason about him, but always experiencing the reality of his own reaction to the world. Here, once again, we find that the ancients are teaching us that the arts help us understand the deeper expression of humanity, just as we are here. Now, I don't want to tie this up entirely today, but I want you to at least as you've listened to some of these, and there's a bit more, I think I'll leave with you as a bit of tantalizing, and I'll try and pick up on this again, not to prolong it. It's like anything, a little bit works wonders. When you overdo it, it is what it is. It's uncomfortable and it's too much. So I'm going to leave you with that. I will come back to it a bit. When you walk away, think about the meaning of what Burns was getting at. And then think, obviously, what that says to you. Blow it off if you have to. It means nothing. The deeper feelings that he never was able to resolve toward somebody who was not invested in a relationship with him. The influence of the people that he fell in with. Robbie Burns was a survivor. And to this day, I'd like to start to read your favorite poem, but unfortunately, I don't know what that one is, or whether you're even a fan of Robbie Burns. So on the 25th, spend a bit of time thinking about the Baird. Maybe we can celebrate that he was a Mason, but an uncommon man, I think we'll admit. Let's at least agree that we still have much to learn by studying. I'm going to play this part out with Peter Morrison singing A Man's a Man. And then we'll come back to a little bit of history.
Let a man be my own.
Not bad. Not bad for a poet who never wore the tartan. Yeah, it was banned at the time. English didn't take kindly to after Kilat. Ah, dear. So if you're wandering around Scotland between Ayr and Dumfries, you'll be walking in the paths of the man. He was the dean of the Brethren of the Mystic Tie. He was the son of the old Kelly. So, some of you have likened the work of Walter Scott. When Walter Scott was a little boy, he was taken to meet Robbie Burns. That's how important it was, the Baird, the common man, every man. Hmm? Fantastic. So, let me talk to you a little bit about a paper by Brother Anthony R. Off. This was presented, this was the Baffham Lecture for 1991. So, for those of you who are searching out interesting terms, I'd like to, and you're starting to apply history, not as descriptions of time gone by, but just reflections of the thinking and being of people, the difference in the thinking of people in the bygone era and what that teaches us today. I like to think of you as the contemporary antiquarian. So for those, I hope you're happy with this this piece. This is called The Origin and Development of Royal Arch Masonry, a short history of the evolution of the organization, government, and the ritual of the Holy Royal Arch. The events and debate leading up to the ritual revisions in 1989 simulated a renewed interest among companions as to the origins and development of the Royal Arch. In 1987, the author was asked to, by his chapter, if he would deliver a lecture structured on a broad overview of what was known of the origins and development. The present lecture had been developed from the earlier presentation. Masonry owes an inestimable debt of gratitude to the Lodges of Masonic Research and to the many learned companions who, over the years, have written papers and delivered lectures on particular aspects of Royal Arch Masonry. I freely acknowledge that without their painstaking research and documentation, this attempt to an overview wouldn't have been possible. Always, we find that things Masonic happen because of a blend of thought and a blend of effort, a combination. Chemistry. It is now generally accepted that by the 18th century, what may be described as the constitutional masonry had become speculative in character. While whether it developed from operative roots in medieval times through various transitions, or whether it borrowed from the medieval masons to provide a tradition and a body of folklore and customs, remains the subject of much Masonic debate. Much of the so-called evidence is conjectural, and hence R.F. Gould, in his History of Freemasonry, describes the earlier period as mythical historical. Well, let's say that myth has its place. The Premier Grand Lodge was formed in 1717, and the first edition of Anderson's Constitutions, published in 1723, mentioned the royal art duly cultivated, the cement of brotherhood preserved so that the whole body resembles a well-built arch. Regulation 2 refers to the master of a lodge having authority to congregate the members into a chapter at pleasure, but neither of these expressions can be taken as implying the existence of a degree or ceremony. The Premier Grand Lodge did not have authority over all lodges in England, and this, combined with the popularity of printed exposures of the ritual, led to problems in the late 1730s. It is from about this date that mention of the Royal Arch begins to occur. In 1743, there was a report in the press of an arch described as royal in an account of a public procession in Ireland, and about the same time a book, the title A Serious and Impartial Inquiry, etc., by Dr. Fitfield Dessinger, I'll spell that, D, the last name, D apostrophe, capital A, S-S-I-G-N-Y, referred to spurious ceremonies performed in Ireland by a person claiming to be a master of the Royal Arch from York.
being unmasked by a brother who had recently received the genuine degree in London. There was a time, and even into North America, where people would make money selling certain so-called secret degrees. And they would come into an area, you think, that we did not have the kind of communication. They weren't able to speak in sentences using Twitter like we have today. So they could make a buck. They would sell the degrees to Masons who trustingly believed that they were authentic. And so we had degrees fabricated. And it was just charlatans and shysters taking advantage. The same kind of thing that goes on today. Not so much necessarily in Masonry, because we do have more cautions, certainly far more cautions. And I think we can all agree this is one of the reasons why we needed that the caution, and we need the protection of our Grand Lodge to watch over this and to emphasize regular Masonry because of the constant, what would have happened, how many more would the market bear, people being, you know, trying to be smooth, convince us that what they were selling was authentic, us digging into our pocket, and then them moving on to the next town before we were any the wiser. In 1752, the problems have widened to the extent that a rival faction familiarly known as the Grand Lodge of the Ancients had come into existence. At an early stage, its secretary, Lawrence Dermot, was warning the brethren as to the need for the detection of impostors who had not to have the least knowledge of Royal Arch Masonry. Of the number of theories which have been advanced regarding the origin of Royal Arch Masonry, many are fanciful and will not be dealt with here. But among those which have been subject to detailed examination are that it was a ceremony existing in Ireland from ancient times. If this were so, it would doubtless have been mentioned in Pennell's Constitutions, published for the Grand Lodge of Ireland in 1730, and which bears a great resemblance to the Royal Arch therein, nor in Sprat's Constitutions of 1744. Again, that it was an importation from the continent. At about this time in France, supporters of the Jacobite cause were developing a complex system of Masonry, and a notable exponent of the system was the Chevalier Ramsay. It is known that Ramsay visited London and met Lawrence Dumont, but there was no evidence to indicate that they collaborated, nor that there was a particular development in Royal Arch Masonry in France in the following period. However, the earliest Royal Arch rituals, or circa 1760, are of French origin. And the next version, that it was a fabrication of Lawrence Dumont and others designed as a justification for the creation of the ancient Grand Lodge by laying claim to a greater measure of antiquity and of possession of secrets not known to the premier Grand Lodge. That, and again, the very last version, that in the process of development of ritual, it was a mutilation of the third degree to form a fourth. However, such chronological evidence as is available is inconclusive. Thus, there are a number of theories, but only a collection of singular facts which are insufficient to constitute any conclusive evidence of the origin of the Royal Arch Masonry. However, the balance of probability points to the Royal Arch being at an embryonic stage by about 1738. The generally accepted date of the commencement of the problems in the Premier Grand Lodge. This being the case, its early development may have been for the purposes already stated in C, but it is still a matter of conjecture. C is that it was a fabrication by Lawrence Dumont and others designed as a justification for the creation of the ancient Grand Lodge by laying claim to a greater measure of antiquity and of a possession of secrets not known to the Premier Grand Lodge. But it is still a matter of conjecture. The consensus of Masonic opinion is that the facts may never become known. The development of organization and government. In 1756, Dumont published his Aihaman Raison, a Hebrew phrase often translated as the faithful brother secretary, subtitled Help to a Brother, which was to become to the ancients what Anderson's constitutions were to the Premier Grand Lodge. It claimed that the ancients possessed degrees neglected by the moderns. One of these was a fourth degree, which firmly referenced, with specific reference to that part of Masonry commonly called the Royal Arch, which I firmly believe to be the root, heart, and marrow of Freemasonry. This was followed by a warning against false Royal Arch Masons. It also contained a monotheistic prayer, which was said to have been repeated in the Royal Arch Lodge at Jerusalem. It is likely that the object of De Motte was to institute an insurmountable barrier between the rival factions, but from the records of both bodies, there is no evidence to suggest that in spite of censure by the respective Grand Lodges, many ordinary lodges and members worked under both constitutions and conferred the various degrees. The ancients stated that arch degree could only be conferred on masters, but because of difficulties in obtaining sufficient numbers of qualified persons, they adopted the subterfuge of introducing the ceremony of passing the chair. In 1759, an Irish Mason by the name of Carroll addressed a petition for assistance to the Premier Grand Lodge. Its Grand Secretary, Samuel Spencer, made the now famous reply, "You, being an ancient Mason, you are not entitled to any of our charity. The ancient Masons have a lodge at the Five Bells in the Strand, whose secretary is one Lawrence Dumont. Our society is neither arch, royal arch, or ancient, so that you have no right to partake of our charity." Needless to say, Carroll received the help he needed, and Dumont had more material to use in castigating the Premier Grand Lodge. He claimed that they now admitted to being modern Masons, and in spite of their protests that they were of an earlier date of constitution and appellations, the appellations modern Mason, and in spite of their protests that they were of an earlier date of constitution, the appellations modern and ancient after that became common usage. In spite of a substantial body of opposition, many prominent members of the Premier Grand Lodge recognized the intrinsic value of the Royal Arch and approved of it, even though they could not tolerate the existence of the rival Grand Lodge. They recognized that there was little hope of future development under the auspices of the Premier Grand Lodge unless positive action was taken, but that having regard to the nature of the opposition, they would have to act in their private capacities. Accordingly, in June 1765, some of them, described as companions of the excellent Grand and Royal Arch, met at the Turk's Head Tavern in Soho and resolved to hold a chapter monthly. In Grand Lodge 1777 to 1967, A. Arch Hewitt records that they enacted bylaws regulating proceedings in the chapter and the wearing of robes and aprons. They laid down requirements for brethren desiring to pass the arch, settled the fees payable, and made arrangements for the safe custody of the cash. We may deduce that this was not the first chapter of the moderns, because the documentation mentions fees for members of the Caledonian chapter and others in the country and beyond the seas. The chapter flourished, and such was its progress that on the 22nd of July of 1766, by a charter of compact, the Grand and Royal Arch Chapter of Jerusalem was constituted. It stated that the companions therein named and their successors were granted our charter of institution and protection, with full powers to hold chapters and assemblies, make, alter, abrogate laws for better conducting and regulating the degree throughout the globe, and to constitute, superintend, and regulate other chapters. It has been said to have been the most momentous meeting of all, and whilst it may have been a self-constituted body, it was to prove, as evidence will show, to be the direct forerunner of the Supreme Grand Chapter of today. Having brought the new body into existence, the companions seem to have been content for a time to retain a low profile. The chapter continued to meet regularly, functioning in an individual capacity, serving the requirements of modern Masons in London, without recognizing or exercising its governing powers. Thus, it was not until 1769 that it began to constitute subordinate chapters, and the making of a public seal for its use ended the period of restraint. Its further development was such that by 1774, it had commenced to warrant overseas chapters, and by 1781, 25 chapters had come into existence, mainly in the provinces, but with these overseas and one in a foreign country. It is necessary at this stage to consider the reaction of the ancients to the existence of a separate governing body for the Royal Arch within the ranks of the moderns. They were doubtless aware that their earlier initiative in the development of Royal Arch Masonry appeared to be passing into the hands of the moderns, but they were now hoist with their own petard. The 1756 Ahemen Raison had laid down their fourth degree, the Royal Arch, as an integral part of their ceremonies and organization within their Grand Lodge. Hence, they could not now divorce it from their proceedings. In 1771, Dermot, who was by then Deputy Grand Master, commenced the practice of informing the ancient Grand Lodge of proceedings of their Royal Arch without making a separate record of the proceedings. In 1783, its regulations were submitted for approval by the ancient Grand Lodge, and from 1788, the chapter regulations were included in the Grand Lodge circular for the year. Hence, it is clear that the Royal Arch body had no separate identity or independence, and we shall see the ambiguity arising from the consequences of this in due course. In society at large, the period around the turn of the 18th century was one of political unrest, which in Britain manifested itself in the form of demands for electoral reform. The events leading to the French Revolution of 1789 must have alerted the British government to the possible consequences of the holding of seditious meetings and the publication of propaganda documents. Accordingly, this led to the issue of several proclamations and the enactment of a series of statutes for the purpose of suppressing such meetings and publications, and for the maintenance of public order. In 1797, against this background, two works attacking Freemasonry were published independently. These produced an immense sensation in society at the time. One was Proofs of a Conspiracy, etc., by Professor Robison. The other, Memoirs pour savoir l'histoire de Jacobinisme, by the Abbé Barruel. He was not, B-A-R-R-U-E-L, he was not a fan of the craft. Abbé. They separately alleged that for many years a secret association had been attempting to root out all the religious establishments and overturn all the existing governments of Europe, and that they had employed as their chief agents the lodges of Freemasons under the direction of an unknown superior. Whilst the Abbé had the candor to admit that English Freemasons were not implicated in the scheme, the professor, until his work had reached the second edition, did not think it necessary to make this distinction. Oh my! The Earl of Morat, acting Grand Master of the Moderns, and John, 4th Duke of Athol, Grand Master of the Ancients, made a joint approach to the Prime Minister, William Pitt, to clear English Freemasonry of the charges to which, to such effect that when in 1799, the Act of Parliament, Statute 39, which soon became known as the Unlawful Societies Act, was passed, the denomination of lodges of Freemasons established prior to the passing of the Act were especially exempted from its operation. However, within the two factions of English Masonry, it may be considered that these events gave it added impetus to a movement towards union. However, in the first decade of the 19th century, it became abundantly clear that the ancients would insist on the inclusion of their fourth degree in the ritual to be established. The diehards among the moderns were convinced that they were being outmaneuvered in allowing the perpetuation of an innovation, whereas the committed Royal Arch Masons were happy with the situation and resolved to request the Duke of Sussex to accept the office of first Grand Principal and he duly accepted. The wording of the Graham Chapter Minute is somewhat quaint. At a special meeting, he is said to have been introduced, duly consecrated, and invested according to ancient form. Having reached this stage, the Grand Chapter, as in the case of the Charter of Compact, then adopted a low profile. And I'll do the same right now. We'll come back. Interesting history. Not to be overlooked. And we'll do this again and again and again. You can see how things work together. We learn one piece of our history, and we see that other parts of our history are tied in. Always an inclusion. Always. It's an interesting, more than interesting, that the history that we study so carefully has so many variations, because there were so many different variables, so many different influences. And it was almost as if we can make a claim about a particular historic fact only by talking about all of the influences that went with it. Now, I hope you know that that Masonic Home Companion is moving into its third year. We have had made this possible because of you. I thank you again for tuning in, and want to leave you with this small tune, and hope that you like it. This is, of course, Robbie Burns, eh? It wouldn't be right unless we moved it along. Grandfather. Thanks, Cyril. Wish you were here. See you all soon. This is Graham.